Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, brought to you from the studios of CBS Interactive. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining me as always, Scott Rowley of PR agency House Party.
Hey Tim.
And today's producer is Brooke Hemphill.
Hello there.
This week, Australia's first web serial and commuter publication MX turns five. It's macarons versus macaroons in the MasterChef ratings blitz. The Gruen transfers plans to take on the politicians and putting the spin on oil spills. Cut down PR services, attempt to put Scott out of a job. Nigel Marsh talks the talk and walks the walk of work-life balance. And the Walkley Foundation talks journalism post the media revolution. So to kick off this podcast this week, a Brisbane production company has launched what they claim to be an Australian first, the first web serial. It's called The Verge. Let's take a listen.
So what can I do for you?
You've got a room to rent.
No.
This is 54.
It's two doors down.
Oh.
Now, we'll start with Brooke. Brooke produces The Mumbo Report, which is the sister video cast that sits alongside the Mumbrella cast. So as a video practitioner, what did you think of it, Brooke?
It was pretty appalling. I think I got through not even the first minute and I had to make it stop.
But why? What was it you didn't like about it?
Well, it was a combination of the bad acting, the production values, the nice little blurry edges around the screen, the titles, what was going on with the voiceover guy. It was just all over
the
shop.
But do you not think that the punters don't notice any of that? I didn't notice the blurry bits around the corners. I didn't notice the voiceover guy. I was kind of focused on the story and the acting.
I think as more and more people go online to watch content, we have iView and people downloading off the internet, all that sort of thing, they are getting used to better production values. Mm. And so I don't think you can get away with rubbish like that anymore.
I agree,
Scott. Did you like
it? You look at the most popular, I think, web serial was Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog by Joss Whedon. You know, and that had really high quality production values, fantastic action, acting, great
sound.
But that
was going to always get millions of views because of the people associated with it.
And absolutely, yeah. But when you watch this...
Can you slaughter, you know, a little Brisbane company for giving it a go and not having the same production values as Joss Whedon?
I think one of the keys to getting something that people want to watch is having a good script. And I think I managed to get about just over 5 minutes into the 7-minute preview. And my problem with it was the childish nature of it. It felt like I was watching Zoo Weekly's...
Isn't that maybe the target audience?
Well, you know, if it is the target audience, then go for it. It felt like they were trying to be spaced, or maybe, you know, the US show, was it Two Guys in a Pizza Place? Felt a bit like they were trying to be one of them.
So the idea, it's about the sexy goings-on when flat-sharing ensues.
Yeah, but that intro with the brothel being two doors down was just so
cheesy.
What on earth made you think it was a brothel?
Oh, come on. The way she said, so what are you looking for? And she tries to drag him into the room. I was like, it's a brothel.
It seemed rather implausible that someone knocks on the door and the person just shows him in. And not only shows him in, but drags him up the hallway by his tie.
And then asks him what he's looking for. Then, I mean, come
yeah,
on.
Well, and then the hilarious misunderstanding ensues when he's got the wrong address. But to me, that was just, you know, a badly telegraphed joke. You sort of knew where it was going to go.
But they were all badly telegraphed, like opening the door and the smoke pouring out of the house from the guy who's been smoking his bong.
A bong sitting right at the front door.
In their defence, they've already accumulated quite a few views. You know, for a little preview that's gone up. You know, we're talking maybe, I forget what, maybe 2,000 or 3,000, which isn't massive, but compared to your average YouTube clip, that's not bad. Mm. And they've done it by being very clever with the tags, you know, or clever or just obvious.
So
they're all threesome, sex, promiscuity, all of those things. So
I can bet you nobody on YouTube has ever typed in the word promiscuity. Do you honestly think anybody looking for sex...
Or possibly promiscuous.
Even then, they would just type in sex.
Hmm. So likely to find an audience, do you think, Brooke?
I don't think so. I mean, we couldn't even get through the preview. It's not like you're going to tune in again for, ooh, let's find out what happens in episode one.
I think you'll find a bunch
ongoing.
Of. I think a bunch of teenage kids at school will be passing it around. If they show girls in underwear or they get, you know, other bits, guys will.
Why would they pass that around if they can just get on the internet and access?
Well, because it gives, sometimes, you know, they want that titillation factor. Plus, it might be in a safe place that they can get to.
I'm going to take a gamble. I think it's going. We'll hate it because, you know,
we're grown ups.
But it will find an audience.
I think it probably will find an audience.
No.
But the question is whether the audience is going to be enough. Now, either they're showcasing the talents of the actors or the directors or what. If that's the crew, of course. Yeah, if that's the job of it, then, you know, maybe they will find something out of that.
Now, the whole ecosystem of video production, sorry, that's a very pretentious way of asking the question, but I kind of get the sense that this is the next thing as we're seeing lots of people are, you know, they're working on projects for the love of it and it putting them in the spotlight rather than necessarily getting paid. Is that, you've been out there, Brooke, is that how it works?
Yeah, that's fairly standard practice with online video. But I think more and more, I recently went to a seminar where they had representatives from SBS and the Movie Network and talking about multi-platform content and about how they're actually commissioning things just for the web. So if they're out there giving the same amount of money for something to be produced that's going online as what they would for something that's being produced for TV, shows like that, just how are they going to compete? Would you watch that versus, say, something like The Jesters on the Movie Network that's also got online content?
I don't know. You've kind of pointed to something that's truly dreadful with The Jesters, really, though, haven't you?
Well, that's true, yeah.
But the question is, would they actually find the same amount of money, or would they see it as a way of reaching audiences more cheaply?
Well, I'm curious how they're monetizing that. Horrible, The Verge. Like, where is the money coming from to make that?
We'll talk about a couple of other projects that you've been involved in the past.
I guess my first online series was with the Sydney Morning Herald, and that was branded content. So that was a show called Sexperts, which was funded by a herpes product.
Scott's head shot up and he said Sexperts.
Yeah, and then I went, I remember that. Ooh.
So, and what came first? Was the advertiser there first and then the project was built around it, or the other way around?
Yeah, the advertiser had approached the Sydney Morning Herald or Fairfax Digital Productions and said, we have some money, we can't really advertise our product because we're a pharmaceutical company. How can we get the name out there? So we then created a weekly online series about sexual health, which was quite enlightening. From that, I went on to work on a show called That's Why You're Single, which is my little pet project. And that's an online dating show, which none of the people pretty much who worked on that were paid.
And that didn't have a sponsor beforehand?
No, and I don't think it does yet.
And that, I suppose, is the question, isn't it? I remember when we did a Mumbo report and we spoke to
Evo TV.
Yes, that was it. I'm glad that you remember.
Vanessa Stoikoff.
The point she made was you don't make this stuff unless you've got a sponsor.
Mm. But I think more and more, there's a series called Freshwater Blue that has recently been picked up by a couple of networks. And
I have
been working with some of the people behind that. But they basically created the show, put it up online as a last resort or as a way of getting it out there. It kind of started to generate interest. And then the networks and then sponsors came and said to them, hey, I think they were approached by companies saying, we want to buy the whole show.
Up next, we talk publishing. Now, late last week, News Limited ran a nice little piece on consumer complaints about poor old keyboard cat and his discomfort at the piano. Funnily enough, an hour or two before, Mumbrella had run that story ourselves. Now, of course, the media has been feeding off itself since the beginning of time, but where do you draw the line? Scott, you were the actual person who, one of two people who first drew my attention to it with a comment on the Mumbrella comment page. Yet you're also a journalist, or yeah, former journalist, who's in that competitive situation where, you know, tabloids often don't credit. So should I shut my whining cake hole?
Yeah, a little bit, to be honest. Look, I used to do the night shift, and when I was doing that, if a rival newspaper had a story that you didn't have, then you'd chase it up and try and, you know, stand it up. If you couldn't stand it up, the story didn't go in, in which case this person who wrote the story, Nicola McIntyre, was it, I think?
Can't remember what the byline was. Don't think that was it, though.
I can't remember.
So apologies to the imaginary Nicola McIntyre.
Whoever wrote the story obviously saw your story, went and investigated it themselves, and appropriated it for their... You know, that's what journalists does. They go out and they find what stories are happening.
And actually, in fairness to journalists, we don't know whether it was that or whether the news desk, you know, gave it to her and asked her to...
Exactly. And it's highly suspicious when it appears after you've done you've trawled through the research, you know, and stumbled upon it.
And the research has been there for a month at that point.
Yeah,
anyway.
I find that highly dubious. And I think that all in all, the reporters probably saw your story, investigate themselves over 2 hours, and then rewritten the story.
Yeah, I suppose my issue, if there is an issue, it isn't even so much about that, because as you say, it's always gone on.
Is it linking?
Well, no, that would have been lovely. You know, a link from a story that's being massively promoted on the homepage of news.com is obviously good for SEO and probably good for traffic as well, although not necessarily the type of traffic we want, but that's a whole other debate altogether. But the issue to me is you've got the likes of News Limited and other big publishers talking about how do they keep their... content, then breaking news exclusive. You know, when it's a one-fact story, how do you stop other people just repeating the fact? So, on the one hand, they're playing that card. On the other hand...
Oh, look, it's highly hypocritical. But let's be honest here, that journalist who probably wrote the story probably just said to the editor, look, I've heard about this, and this story's landing in my lap. I want to chase it up. I can find out in the next hour the truth, and we can get it up. And they went, brilliant, we'll do that.
Okay, still on publishing, still on newspapers. Another little thing I just happened to notice, because it really got underplayed this week. In Sydney, MX, the free commuter paper, celebrated its fifth birthday this week. I only noticed because there was a tiny little, you know, round label on the front saying we're five today. I just wonder whether people don't take MX seriously enough.
I only pick up MX occasionally because I drive into work. And really, I get the train. It's what it is. MX is a newspaper designed as a kind of fast food newspaper. You know, you get in the train, you read it, you put it down. Next person comes along, picks up, puts it down. A lot of the picture stories in it are from public relations companies who organise stunts, and then they go around, take a picture, and they go, brilliant, there's a page one picture, a page three picture, a page five picture.
But to me, that's almost the beauty of it. What it's doing is it's capturing a different audience and a different market.
Absolutely.
You know, who maybe don't buy a newspaper, so you're maybe even bringing people back into the newspaper habit. So
yeah, as I said, it's fast food. You're going to get more people probably enjoying that than they do enjoy the Daily Telegraph,
I get the
Sydney Morning Herald.
No one at News Limited, for instance, ever seems terribly proud of it.
Look, I think if you're going to read a newspaper on a train or in any form of public transport, I think the SMH is the worst newspaper. Broadsheets are not designed to be enjoyed in a cramped space.
I was thinking about this yesterday, crammed on a bus, because I remember, you know, I've had various conversations with people at Fairfax saying, you know, why don't you make it tabloid size, not tabloid and Outlook, call it compact or whatever you want to. So that I can read it on this bus right now. And then I found myself thinking, I wonder when the last time the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald was on a bus in the rush hour.
Well, it's like
any of the senior people at Fairfax that have to make that decision.
It was like the Guardian used to do an international edition, and that was great because it was tabloid size, so you could read the Guardian.
Still is, weekly,
I've not seen it in a while. And I loved the fact I could pick it up, open it up, and sit and read it on a train when I used to get the train to work. And I think that's great. But you're right. The last time the editor probably of the SMH jumped in a train or was on a bus cramped in, long time ago.
I think before the downturn, Fairfax were talking about going for the Berliner size, which is what the Guardian have done in the UK. And then that was kind of shelved because this is where the technology gets beyond me slightly. But I understand that most presses can either comfortably print a broadsheet or a tabloid format. But if you go for Berliner, which is in between the two, you have to get new presses or new equipment. So it's a much bigger investment. And
just got a tabloid size. Everybody prefers reading the newspapers that way.
One of the issues, I think, is the advertising one. Mm. An advertiser who's bought a page in a broadsheet will not necessarily feel they're getting the same impact with a page in a compact.
And they probably want to say, well, then people are probably booked up for the next year, so they'd have to do it a year in advance, that kind of stuff.
Next up, we talk television. So in the ratings this week, MasterChef has continued to outdo itself. Monday night's Macaroon Challenge netted over 2 million, did the same on Wednesday night as well. Sunday did similarly too. So it's going great guns. This week was kind of a relatively weird ratings week because of State of Origin. But even then, the Gruen transfer, for instance, also held up, as did MasterChef against it. First question, though, Brooke, and one that, that happily you settled for our office, macarons or macaroons?
Well, apparently macarons are French. We consulted the good source Wikipedia, and the challenge that they made, and I actually was watching it with my housemate, and when they passed the recipe to the contestants, he's like, they misspelt macaroons on the top of the recipe. So he was adamant that it's definitely macaroons, but apparently not.
Well, I noticed news.com, the top story earlier in the week was a story about the difference between macarons and macaroons. So again, there's something weird about MasterChef where it catches the public's attention with these tiny things. Like last year, everyone was obsessed with croquembouche, which, am I right in thinking, is profiteroles?
Yes, or? Yeah, it's a tower of profiteroles.
Yeah. But glazed in some kind of toffee, I think, or something.
Yeah, I never ever watched MasterChef
Sorry,
last
distracted.
Year.
Yeah.
I had not watched a single episode of MasterChef last year, and this year I have actually found myself wrongly getting into it and sitting around with my housemates
Nothing
and all being
wrong
like,
with MasterChef.
Ooh,
you should be quite proud of it.
Yeah, it's funny actually, the macaron macaroon thing kind of reminded me of when I first came here and I said maroon to my friends and they said maroon, you know, and it made me realise that whole maroon.
It takes us to the whole state of origin debate.
Yeah, yes. but when I heard this macaron, I kind of went, oh, maybe somebody's obviously got mixed up, and that's obviously what's happened.
You say potato. I had a brilliant story about somebody who learned
how to... You see, I have a brilliant story?
Well, no, I heard a brilliant story about somebody who, quite a good singer, but had never heard that song sung before and had to do some sort of audition. And obviously she just learned it off paper, so she sang it as, you say potato, I say potato.
Oh, wow.
Led a sheltered life.
Yeah, which is something of a digression.
You think you go research that song on YouTube or something?
Let's try and refocus slightly. We mentioned Gruen Transfer. Mm-hmm. Now, interesting, the Gruen Transfer is going to rebadge as the Gruen Nation during the election, which is a kind of interesting step. But this week, the Gruen Transfer was, amongst other things, I spent a lot of time talking about deodorant, actually.
Yeah,
but also... asked agencies, and it was Lunch Partners versus UORSCG, to help reposition a troubled company after an oil spill. Let's hear a clip.
The PB oil spill. It's the worst environmental disaster in human history. 16 million litres of oil gushing into the ocean every day. Seabird populations and fisheries decimated. They're unlikely to recover in our lifetime. Brilliant.
Scott, did you like that ad?
Yeah, I like both ads, actually.
So that one we just heard was the Lunch Partners one, which won.
Yeah.
And that was Tim Flannery.
I mean, obviously getting Tim Flannery to do the advert's great because of his connection with environment in Australia. I thought that ad struck a chord, you know. It was spin, and it was that way of kind of pushing a message that they're doing really well and pushing this green message out there. And they got the right person behind it to push that message. It nailed it for me as an advert. You know, you'd watch that and you go, yeah, I get this, BP. They're doing so well for us at the moment. I'm so happy about that. Or PB, as they called them in the advert. However, it's usually the case of spin doctors rather than advertising agencies that do that kind of thing. So it was interesting to see the ad agency getting behind it.
And I guess the thing is, in a way, the job it's doing is... public relations job, which funnily enough is what we'll be talking next. Now, Melbourne agency JMM Communications have launched their PR Guru service. I thought Scott was our PR guru, where they offer to bash out a press release in less than 24 hours and offer up a media list for just $40. Scott, you work in PR. You're finished if this takes off, aren't you?
I should just quit now and walk out, go. Will it take off? Some agencies, some companies might jump on and say, yeah, great, it's going to save us X amount of cash. Honestly, writing a press release isn't a 24-hour job at times. You know, you've got to write it, and then you've got to send it to the client. Client's got to say, well, actually, these facts need to get changed. We need these quotes, or they might want to add in extra quotes. Then you're back and forward. Then it's got to go through the legal process. You know, there's a lot to do in a press release. And to be honest, PR is not just about a press release. That's the smallest part of it all. And then the media list section.
Now, I was going to ask you, what do you think a media list is actually worth?
It varies, I think. I think it depends on...
Is $40 selling yourself cheap, do you think?
Well, I think it is. But then again, most PR agencies already use like Media Atlas, which is run by AAP. And, you know, if they've got that, then you've got access to the entire database. So if you've already got a PR agency, then...
Although I suppose arguably if you have, then you probably wouldn't use this service.
Yeah, I think this service will be a case of little small companies small to medium size, going to these guys and say, write us a press release, do that, and then that's it, it goes out, and yeah, most journalists will ignore it.
I suppose the other questions, I noticed that Wilkinson Group announced something similar, a couple of weeks back, where they offer this kickstart service where they'll come in and consult, and this is sort of aimed at, you know, small or medium-sized businesses, consult with them for a month or maybe 3 months, effectively get them set up to manage their own PR.
Mm.
Is that something that would work, do you think?
Look, I think for small companies, yes. I think on a much larger scale and medium-sized businesses, you really need a PR professional trained. You can't train somebody in 3 months to do PR for you. You know, they don't have graduate courses for that for no reason. You know, it's a full communication suite. And the PR roles change so much that it's incorporating a lot of marketing these days. You know, you've got a lot of online stuff. You've got to look at influencers online. You've got to also look at, you know, the journalists offline. You've got to deal with a lot of different types of relationships and different ways of approaching them. So all in all, I think it leaves companies very vulnerable. 3 months in, they think they can do everything, and you know, if a crisis happens, then they might get stuffed.
Next up, big moves in ad agency land. So the dramatic news this week was that Nigel Marsh was leaving Y&R Brands, which is a very tough job indeed. Lots of, you know, when he took it on, lots of troubled agencies within the group. There was a big legal case going on with GP Y&R and the circumstances in which that was purchased. People going out the door, business going out the door. I think most people would say that he's kind of sort of stabilised the ship, moved in Russell Howcroft, who will transition in as his replacement. Russell Howcroft, who you might know from the Gruen transfer. But I guess one of the things that that got people talking about Nigel Marsh, again, he's already written a couple of books, as most people would know, was he gave one of the more interesting talks at TEDx, the work-life balance one. Let's just hear a clip from that now.
So I stepped back from the workforce and I spent a year at home with my wife and four young children. But all I learned about work-life balance from that year was that I found it quite easy to balance work and life when I didn't have any work.
Now, Scott, after the Nigel Marsh clip, I remember you sent a tweet.
Yeah.
Do you remember what the tweet was?
Probably not.
About how you were going home to see your lovely girlfriend because you were inspired to spend more time with her.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, because I was. You know, I thought he was excellent. He was him and a woman called Rachel, who was at the TEDx Sydney thing. Two of them were fantastic, really inspiring. You know, one on this recycling and free cycling type stuff. And then Nigel talking about having the work-life balance. And I think he had it spot on. It made you realise that sometimes you do spend a little bit too much time at work, or you spend too much time doing other things when you should be spending with the people you care about.
Brooke, your take?
Yeah, I think that's on the money, but I mean, sometimes it's hard to control. And I know with me at the moment, I'm working 3 days a week with you, Tim, and then I have 2 days, which over the last month were 2 days that I ended up kind of spending at home watching stuff on my laptop.
And that's work-life balance.
Yeah, see, I don't know if that is work-life balance.
That's work-sloth balance, yes. I think. Yeah, and then I think it all kind of comes at once for me, that suddenly I don't have a minute to spare. And so you have to take it when you can and enjoy that downtime.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that he was right in saying that, you know, you really need to start planning part of it out. You need to say, well, you know, these are my key priorities. And you know, these other things that I do that aren't really a priority but I want to do, you know, maybe I should just be bypassing them sometimes and doing the things I really do want to do.
Yeah, the argument being that you can't sort out your work-life balance over a single day,
yeah,
but a whole lifetime of work is too long,
yeah,
a period. How many hours a week do you reckon you work?
I don't know, 50, 55, 60.
But the other question is, where do you draw the line between work and personal when you're at industry events in the evening and that sort of thing? What, yeah.
I wasn't adding in industry events there. It's a tough one, you know. I know a lot of people in the industry, so I tend to, you know, if I go to these events, I do enjoy myself, but there is still that thing that you're going to maybe two events a week. You know, that's 4 hours, that's 8 hours, you're putting in extra.
But you sort of have to, don't you, in this
industry? Yeah, you do, absolutely, because a lot of it's networking. It's about building your connections, building your network, and then, you know, trying to get new business from a lot of that. So it can be tough. I do tend to spend a lot of time away from home. I mean, it's just one of those things. And it's what most people in this industry, most in this, you know, big communications, marketing, ad agencies all have to do.
Now, lastly today, we'll be talking journalism. The Walkley Foundation and also the Media Alliance is going to be running a 4-day conference to debate what journalism will look like post the media revolution. Now, Scott, the thing I really liked about their announcement, well, apart from the fact they got some really good speakers,
great names,
both
yeah.
from Australia and globally, is the fact that it's not, or they're trying not to have it, that same old thing about our newspapers going to die. They're trying to move the conversation on to what journalism will look like after the revolution.
Yeah,
it's a tough question, but how do you think
very
it is going to look?
Oh, you know, one of my bugbears, I suppose, is journalism bloggers, blogger journalist type thing, who don't check facts. And, you know, and I hope that down the line we have a standard online and offline of people checking facts before they run stories, because it can damage brands, it can damage reputations, you know, and there's a lot of cases out there, you know, defamation, there's a lot of defamation cases just waiting to happen with keyboard warriors going out and attacking people. And I think that balanced up with blogger journalism, who can get it wrong, as can normal journalists, don't get me wrong. I think that we need to find that something out there.
My question to you on that would be, where does blogger journalism become bloggers? You know,
and that's that. Some of them are wannabe journalists, and you know, try and write stories that can hurt companies.
Yeah, but aren't they entitled to express opinions?
That's where it's becoming this. A lot of them call themselves journalists, but what they are is opinion people. You know, they're not actual journalists.
So how about you have to get some sort of, you know, kind of qualification, much like a doctor, in order to call yourself a journalist? You have to pass some sort of series of exams.
Well, see, I would say that, but then some of the best journalists
I was joking.
I know, I was going to say, but some of the best journalists I've worked with don't have qualifications, you know, just got into it through being good writers and dogged reporters and having that tenacity to go for something. I think it's a tough one. I think really the future journalism, I don't think MD really knows at the moment, and it'll be interesting to see what comes out of this talk.
Yeah, good conference, I think. That's all we have time for today. My thanks as ever to co-host Scott Rohde.
Thanks, Tim.
And for today to Brooke Hemphill.
Thank you.
And to CBS Interactive for use of their studio. That was the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows.